Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 468 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. But this is going to be series 98. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that for the last 2 hours, he has been having a very severe headache. And they tell you that he has vision loss in both eyes. In fact, it is mentioned that he has lost vision in the outer half of both eyes. If you see something like that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would hope that you'd be thinking about some kind of stroke. In fact, if you wanted to maybe be smarter about localizing it, I would think about an anterior communicating artery stroke. The person basically has bitemporal hemianopsia. So what's the deal there? Well, the deal here is that this person probably had some kind of aneurysm in the circle of Willis. And then that aneurysm ruptured. And then as a result of that, you had like bleeding in the anterior part of the brain. And you have like a bitemporal hemianopsia. In fact, if you even have just an aneurysm of the anterior communicating artery, that can certainly compress the optic chiasm and you can get a bitemporal hemianopsia. Remember, when a person has a bitemporal hemianopsia, the high yield thing to know is that you're going to lose your outer visual field in both eyes, your outer visual field in both eyes. So like the outer half in both eyes, that's going to be bitemporal hemianopsia. So now the big question then begs, who are the people that typically get aneurysms in the circle of Willis? Well, I mean, normal people can get aneurysms in the circle of Willis, but our friends at the USMLEs, they also love if you know certain diseases that have these associations. So like, for example, people that have Marfan's. Marfan's is associated with people having aneurysms in the circle of Willis. Autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease is also associated with people having aneurysms in the circle of Willis. All these things can cause aneurysms. And again, these aneurysms can pop and that can cause a lot of problems. Now, what if they give you a question about a 29-year-old male and they tell you that he's brought to the hospital by his wife because for the last 2 days, he has been having very severe headaches. He has been having some visual difficulty. He has been having neck stiffness. And then they give you, they give you a bunch of vital signs. You notice that his temperature is like 102 degrees Fahrenheit. His blood pressure is like 90 over 60. He's tachycardic. He's tachypneic. And he has a fever, as I've already mentioned. And then they say, which of the following is the most appropriate empiric therapy for this patient's presentation? I was really hoping that situation you're saying, oh, Divine, I think it would be wise for me to give this person some element of ceftriaxone and some element of vancomycin. And I'll say plus or minus steroids in this circumstance. So what's the deal there? So this person sounds an awful lot like they have bacterial meningitis. I know you may be like, but Divine, could it not be viral? Could it not be fungal? Could it not be TB? Again, if we're just going with most common presentation that underlies what I just said, bacterial meningitis is the thing that makes the most sense. One thing I'm going to comment on here is we live in a world, especially of USMLE takers, where people are so focused on getting the exact, what is that one thing here that tells me, oh, this is exactly what's going on? That's not a wise way to take the USMLE exams. The USMLE exams are almost like based on probabilities. That's one way I like to think of the USMLEs. I think of it as a probability-based exam. You ask yourself with the question that has been given, what is the most likely thing that is being tested here? What is the thing of highest probability that's being tested with this question that is placed right before me? Right? You see a person with crazy high fevers, nuchal rigidity, youngish person, acute presentation. Again, it's almost certainly, like if they had to make you like play odds, you're playing the lottery, I would probably put my money on bacterial meningitis because it's just the thing that makes the most sense in this circumstance. So in this circumstance, I would certainly be giving this person a combination of ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and steroids. That's what I'd be doing, like CVS. Just remember CVS, like the drugstore chain. So why that? Well, the thing is, the most common cause of meningitis is going to be strep pneumo. Strep pneumo is the most common cause of meningitis, right? So we're going to give ceftriaxone because it's going to cover it very beautifully. But another thing we do is we're going to say, okay, let's go ahead and give Venk, because Venk can also cover Staph aureus. Although, also don't forget that ceftriaxone can also cover Neisseria meningitis. Because yes, Neisseria meningitis is not necessarily the most common cause of meningitis, but it's pretty common as well. So you want to basically cover all your bases when you're giving a person empiric therapy. That's why we give ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and we give steroids. Ceftriaxone and venc will pretty much cover most of the notable gram positives and gram negatives that can cause meningitis. And then steroids are generally indicated when you're worried about strep pneumo meningitis. When you're worried about strep pneumo meningitis, you got to add steroids in those circumstances. And then obviously, as you then get like a lumbar puncture and you get like gram stain results and CSF culture results, you can then reorganize your therapy accordingly. But empirically, believe it or not, you will get questions on your exams where you have to treat a disease empirically. Empiric treatment of meningitis, very, very high yield to know. In general, you want to do ceftriaxone and vancomycin. They may not throw in steroids as part of the answer, but for sure, you want to give ceftriaxone and vancomycin. Now, remember, the empiric treatment of meningitis is different if you're talking about like a neonate or you're talking about a person over age 50. When you're dealing with a neonate or a person over age 50, then in addition to giving ceftriaxone and vancomycin, you also have to give ampicillin. Because people that are neonates, people that are over age 50, they are predisposed to getting meningitis from Listeria. Listeria, the most effective drug for covering listerial infection, is ampicillin. So it's pretty helpful in those circumstances to give those people ampicillin just to empirically cover Listeria. Because Listeria meningitis, I believe, has a really bad mortality if you pretty much don't treat it and treat it on time. So it's just one of these weird things that you kind of need to keep in mind for your test. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a child, and they tell you that this child, you know, for the past 7 days, this child has been having like really high fevers, and they tell you that this child has also been having like some chest pain. In fact, over the last 2 days, the child has been having chest pain, and they tell you that, oh, that you listen to the child's chest, and you hear a holosystolic murmur. You hear a holosystolic murmur at the apex. You're like, holosystolic murmur at the apex. You're like, that's kind of weird. And then they also tell you that in the Q-stem that this child has cervical lymphadenopathy. But they tell you that this child does not have any edema of the throat, doesn't have any infiltrates or exudates on the throat. And then you're also told that this child has significant right upper quadrant pain. If you see, and you know, they'll say like in the question that, oh, at a doctor's visit like a month ago, there was no murmur heard in this child's chest, right? And then you may see, they may give you a picture of like the tongue in this child or whatever. When you put all these things together, what are you thinking about? I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like Kawasaki's disease. Maybe like, wait, what? In fact, like, kind of want to break down this topic because it's something that people could really whiff on exams. And I wouldn't want you to whiff on this stuff. But they could give you a question about a child with just this disparate set of symptoms. You see cervical lymphadenopathy. You see these very high fevers that have been going on for a couple of days. You notice that the child may have like even some valvular issues like a mitral regurg. You may notice that they may have like coronary artery aneurysms. You can even see this right upper quadrant pain because sometimes in Kawasaki's disease, the inflammation spreads to the right upper quadrant. And when it spreads there, you can basically have like edema of the wall of the gallbladder. That's what's called gallbladder hydrops. That can certainly happen. And then remember, these people can also have a rash on their palms and soles, although they won't always mention it like that. they can turn that rash to edema. They can say, oh, this person has edema of the hands and feet. When you see stuff like that, you want to think about Kawasaki's disease. You want to think about Kawasaki's disease. Now, what are some things that you could have conflated this with? Well, one of the things you could have conflated this with is rheumatic fever. In fact, I kind of figured that if I mentioned the valvular thing, oh, people will just eat up rheumatic fever. Just be careful, right? Rheumatic fever, right? Usually they would have given you some kind of group A strep antecedent in the question. Group A strep usually causes some kind of pharyngitis. So you're going to see like some throat findings, like literally inside the throat. That's just something you want to keep in mind. They will tell you some information about a rapid strep test. Another way you could have also screwed this up is thinking about mono, right? Because people are like, oh, mono, divine right upper quadrant, maybe hepato something, something megaly. Yes, it could also be mono. But again, mono causes a pharyngitis. Mono causes lymphadenopathy, which this child had, but you know, this child did not have pharyngitis. And I didn't really mention anything about an age or a situation where the child could have kissed someone, right? Like mono is going to be something that you're going to be seeing in a teenager or older on your exams. So say, for example, a person is like 5 or 6 years old. I will probably not pick mono for that person. It doesn't really make sense to pick that kind of answer. There has to be some very significant extenuating circumstances in a question for you to go down that pathway. So Kawasaki's disease. So what are some big things to keep in mind with Kawasaki's disease? Well, people that have Kawasaki's disease, typically you're going to see them, they're going to have like fever for a couple of days. You're going to see them have, sometimes they can have cardiac abnormalities. That can be actually a presentation. Believe it or not, an MI can be a presentation of Kawasaki's disease. I'm going to say that again. An MI in a little child can be a presentation of Kawasaki's disease. Be very, very careful about that. Be very, very careful about that. An MI can be a presentation of Kawasaki's disease in a little child. So you see a little child with an MI, and you see the child has like a fever with the MI. One of the first things I want you to think about is Kawasaki's disease. Or you see a child that has a fever, they have an MI, and you see like mitral problems, like mitral insufficiency that develops acutely. I also want you to think about Kawasaki's disease, okay? I know some of these things I'm saying may sound like unusual presentations, but I promise you these are very high yield presentations to know for the purposes of your exams. Now, Kawasaki's disease, what are some other things to know here? Well, again, as I've said, these people can have coronary artery aneurysms. In fact, this is one of the reasons why these people get aspirin and IVIG, okay? This is one of the reasons why these people get aspirin and IVIG, right? Aspirin and IVIG. Because Kawasaki's disease is an example of a kind of a vasculitis, right? And remember, they also have like a rash on the palms and soles. Now, one thing I also want to bring up here, and honestly, I don't know why this is the case, but this is something you definitely need to know for exams, is that Kawasaki's disease has a pretty solid association with thrombocytosis. I'm going to say that again. Kawasaki's disease has a pretty strong association with thrombocytosis. That is super, super, super high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. People can have Kawasaki's and have thrombocytosis. Why? Honestly, I've not really found a good explanation in all my reading, but that's something that I would strongly encourage you to know for exams. Now, one thing I want to comment on here is, what are some causes of acute mitral regurg? Because the pattern of development of acute mitral regurg, the pattern of development of mitral regurg can tell you certain things on your exams. In fact, let's discuss mitral regurg from a few different perspectives, because it's one of these things that it's just one of these like innocuous concepts, just kind of pops up out of the blue on exams, and people kind of shake with those things. I don't want you to be one of those people. So if you see acute mitral regurg, especially in a very young child, and you notice that they have a fever, one of the things I want you again to think of is, I certainly want you to think of either rheumatic fever or Kawasaki's disease. But again, I've already explained to you how you can differentiate rheumatic fever from Kawasaki's disease. Now, if you see a person develop acute mitral regurg, and the person has like a bad medical history, right? They're obese, they have like hypertension, they are smokers, blah, 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 blah. And you see that this mitral regurg develops like super suddenly, like literally within like a few hours, you see them develop pulmonary edema. I want you to think of that person having an MI. So what exactly is happening there? Well, the thing that's happening is that they have a papillary muscle rupture. They've literally ruptured their papillary muscles. They've literally ruptured it, right? Sometimes on exams, instead of calling it papillary muscle rupture, they'll they'll call it rupture of the Chordae tendon. They'll call it rupture of the Chordae tendon. Rupture of the Chordae tendon. Those are structures that support the papillary muscle. So if those things rupture, then you're going to have this acute onset mitral regurgitation. Again, it's just one of these weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then if you see a person develop chronic mitral regurg, you notice that, man, over time, person is developing mitral regurg, then I want you to think of that person having some kind of dilated cardiomyopathy. So why does dilated cardiomyopathy cause mitral regurg that is chronic? Well, the thing is, dilated cardiomyopathy will cause mitral regurg that is chronic because, again, what exactly does it do? Basically, what it's going to do is, you're going to have a dilation of the left ventricle. When you dilate the left ventricle, you're essentially going to pull the mitral valve leaflets apart. When you pull the mitral valve leaflets apart, well, the thing that's going to happen is that blood is then going to be refluxing back into the left atrium, right? And over time, that can present as mitral regurg. Okay, mitral regurg can be a presentation of dilated cardiomyopathy on exams. And again, remember, our friends at the USMLEs, they can give dilated cardiomyopathy many different names. They can call it eccentric hypertrophy on exams. They can call it chronic volume overload on exams. Again, remember, this is one of the hallmarks of the USMLEs these days, is taking what you know and just being more descriptive or putting it in other terms, right? Because again, I feel like the USMLEs these days, they're trying to ferret out to people that truly understand what's going on. They're trying to ferret out people that have not just blindly memorized their way through things, but can actually like critically think and reason through what they have memorized, through what they have learned. So again, I'm just kind of sounding, I've sounded this call out to people many, many, many times. I'm on this podcast. There's nothing wrong with memorizing stuff, but make sure you understand and can reason through stuff. And not just understand or reason through stuff, but ask yourself, what is the story behind this thing? Many people will be well served to learn things in the story format on USMLE exams. Like as they're studying, they're learning the story behind the pathology. When you learn the story behind the pathology, then it'll be very easy for you to recognize those things on exams. That's just the truth. But let's go ahead and continue. So as I wrap up today, one thing I think I want to focus on is to discuss some of the uses of aspirin on exams. Because, you know, sometimes people wonder, when can I use aspirin on the USMLE exams? Believe it or not, there are actually a myriad of weird associations with aspirin that I would say will be pretty helpful for you to know for your test, right? So the first one we've kind of talked about, you can use aspirin for Kawasaki's disease. You know, in general, you'll try to avoid giving aspirin to little kids. But in Kawasaki's disease, you throw that rule out the window. You can give aspirin to little kids that have a Kawasaki's disease. Now, what's the second association with Kawasaki's disease? When a person has an ischemic stroke that is not of a cardiac origin, because remember, you can get ischemic strokes on USMLE exams in general for two major reasons. You can get it from the carotids, or you can get it from the heart. Usually, people that get it from the heart, which is less common, are people that have AFib or have had a recent MI. But if you have like an ischemic stroke because of a carotid problem, one of the treatments you should strongly consider is aspirin. Obviously, if you're less than 4.5 hours from symptom onset and it's an ischemic stroke, the first thing you're going to give is TPA, kind of like the smart play. But once you're done giving TPA, in terms of what the person should be on long term, I will strongly encourage you to consider putting those people on aspirin. Strongly consider putting those people on aspirin. When people have ischemic strokes, they need to be on antiplatelet agents. When they have ischemic strokes of carotid origin, which again is the most common kind of ischemic stroke, go ahead and put those people on antiplatelet agents like aspirin or clopidogrel or dipyridamole. Usually aspirin is the go-to on exams. But remember, if a person has a stroke from a cardiogenic source, let's say they have AFib, or they have mitral stenosis, or they have whatever, please do not put them on an antiplatelet agent. Put them on an anticoagulant, something like warfarin, something like apixaban, something of that nature. Just be wise, be smart, okay? It seems like a subtle difference, but it's a common difference I've seen many med students kind of mess up on exams. You don't want to be one of those people. Now, what's the third use of aspirin? The third use of aspirin is in peripheral arterial disease. Actually, every single person that has peripheral arterial disease has to be on aspirin. Because again, peripheral arterial disease is basically like atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis of a person's lower extremity vessels. That's more of a thrombotic phenomenon. Those people certainly should be on an antiplatelet agent like aspirin. And then remember, when you've had an MI, one of the first drugs you're supposed to get is aspirin. It's one of the drugs you get in the acute phase of an MI. But also, after a person has had an MI and they get a stent placed in their hearts, they need to be on dual antiplatelet therapy. That dual antiplatelet therapy is usually going to be aspirin and some other drug, typically something like clopidogrel, a P2Y12 inhibitor. Now, another thing to keep in mind with aspirin for exams is that you can use it as eclampsia prophylaxis, right? So if a woman has had like eclampsia in a previous pregnancy, you're like, gee, I don't want this woman to have this problem again in future pregnancies. When she gets pregnant again, go ahead and put her on aspirin. Go ahead and put her on aspirin. And then don't forget that aspirin can cause tinnitus. Aspirin can absolutely positively cause tinnitus. It can cause tinnitus. That's something you want to keep in mind on exams. And then what are the acid-base anomalies you can get when you take aspirin or you overdose on aspirin? Well, the acid-base anomalies you can get is you can get a respiratory alkalosis and a metabolic acidosis at the same time. Many people, for purposes of their USMLE exams, actually many resources have taught people this, is this whole concept of... In fact, I may have thought this in the past, but this is something that I've pretty much kept solidly in mind for years, that those two problems show up at the same time, right? Many people learn that, oh, wait, you get the respiratory alkalosis first, and then you get the metabolic acidosis later. That is not true, okay? Because you see some people, they'll get these arrow questions involving acid-base problems and aspirin, and then they'll only pick the answer that shows respiratory alkalosis alone. And then they won't pick the one that reflects respiratory alkalosis and metabolic acidosis. Please, let me tell you right now. Both of those problems crop up when you have aspirin toxicity, right? It revs up your respiratory rate, so you're going to blow CO2. You're going to get a respiratory alkalosis from that. But you're also going to get a metabolic acidosis for two reasons. One, aspirin is literally known as acetylsalicylic acid. Okay, it's an acid. So just based on acid base, you know right off the bat, you're going to get a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. But that's not all. Aspirin is also an uncoupling agent. It kind of works like dinitrophenol. It's an uncoupling agent of the electron transport chain. So basically, you will not be able to make ATP. You're pretty much wasting that proton gradient that you have in your inner mitochondrial, in your intermembrane space of your mitochondria. So basically, yes, you're doing everything. Most of your electron transport chain is happening. But basically, aspirin uncouples that process. And when it uncouples that process, you pretty much just generate a lot of heat. So your body is going to start depending a lot on glycolysis to give it any kind of useful energy like ATP. So you're going to be making a lot of lactic acid. That can certainly cause you to become acidotic. Okay. So please, aspirin, please, I want you to disband this from your mind of, oh, respiratory alkalosis first, metabolic acidosis down the line. No. Is respiratory alkalosis and metabolic acidosis at the same time. I'm going to say that again, at the same time. That's pretty high yield to know for exams. That's pretty, pretty high yield to know for exams. Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I think those are, well, I guess maybe I'll just throw in one more aspirin factoid here, right? So you see a person that, you know, they've been taking aspirin for like pain or whatever, and then you notice that, you know, they've been having asthma-style symptoms, they've been having nasal polyps. This is pretty easy, right? This is aspirin-induced asthma. I believe these days it's called aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. Well, what's the pathophase behind that? Well, the pathophase, as you know, aspirin is a COX inhibitor. It's an irreversible inhibitor of COX-1 and COX-2. Well, guess what? If you shut down COX-1 and COX-2, then arachidonic acid needs to be useful in life. So how is it going to get useful? It's going to get useful by getting shunted down the lipoxygenase pathway into making leukotrienes. Well, leukotrienes, they can cause bronchospasm. They can cause asthma-like symptoms, right? So that's actually the pathophase behind aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. Because basically, by shutting down the cyclooxygenase pathway, then the only fate for arachidonic acid is like, okay, I'm going to go down the lipoxygenase pathway. And you're going to make all these leukotrienes, again, which can cause a lot of airway problems that can certainly cause asthmatic symptoms. Aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease has a classic association with nasal polyposis, okay? Has a pretty strong association with nasal polyposis, right? And again, by the way, if you ever see nasal polyposis, okay, let me take a step back real quick. So that aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease, how can you treat it? Well, obviously, a wise thing is to probably stop taking aspirin. It's probably not a smart idea. That's one. But the second thing I would say to keep in mind there is maybe using a leukotriene antagonist, like a leukotriene receptor blocker, something like Montelukast or Zafirlukast. Or you can use a lipoxygenase inhibitor, like Zileuton, for example, Zileuton. Those are very effective therapies for managing aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. Okay. And then with nasopolyposis, I don't know, just all these higher things just kind of flying into my brain. But nasopolyposis, remember your exams, think of aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease. Think of cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a very common cause of nasopolyposis on exams. And then also think of just chronic rhinosinusitis with nasopolyposis. That's also something that causes nasopolyposis on exams. We treat that with inhaled corticosteroids. And then a fourth cause of nasopolyposis on exams, believe it or not, is Wegener's granulomatosis. Remember, Wegener's, these days we call it GPA, granulomatosis with polyangiitis. That can also present with nasopolyposis. Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, okay? Something you certainly want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then don't forget that aspirin can also precipitate gout attacks. Why? Because it can raise your uric acid levels. Okay, so if a person has a history of like gout, aspirin is not maybe the smartest idea in those people. It's only if they really, really need that aspirin for like a really, really big reason. Like say, for example, they've had like an MI, for example. And remember as well, aspirin is the drug we use for pericarditis in people that have had MIs. For the first 6 months after you've had an MI, you cannot take any other NSAID but aspirin. Why? Because again, you can have a pretty high risk of myocardial rupture. So again, just be smart, be wise, right? Aspirin is the NSAID you can take for pericarditis. Really, again, for the first 6 months after an MI, don't go taking any other kind of NSAID like ibuprofen. You're just going to rupture your myocardium, and that's going to be a very bad, very bad thing. Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, thank you for joining me. For those of you that are studying for step two, step three, or step one, I have a bunch of classes that are coming up, actually starting like tomorrow, right? So I have a test taking strategies class. It's 2.5 hours long. It's for step one all the way to step three. That's tomorrow. On Friday, I have a biostatistics class. If you struggle with biostats, you're taking step one to step three. That class is exactly what you need. On Saturday, I have a 5-hour class that covers quality improvement, social sciences, healthcare systems, ethics, and whatnot. Let me tell you this. These classes are not lectures. They are all based on stories. They are all based on scenarios. They are all based on clinical presentations, because that's exactly the way your USMLE exams will be, right? So that's one benefit of my review courses, I would say, is you're not just learning the concept, but you're learning the story. You're learning the context behind that concept. Is a much more efficient, much more effective way to learn and prepare for exams. And then if you're taking step two or step three, next week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, it's a 4-day course. I am actually going to be having the 20-hour step two, step three review. It's also helpful for people that are like preparing for shelf exams. So if you're interested in any of these courses, just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. They are all held over Zoom. Most of them are in the evening, so you should be able to partake of them. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for step one, step two, step three, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. I also help people with ERAS applications, so personal statements, recommendation letters, editing those things, editing applications, editing supplemental applications, doing mock interviews. I do all those things with people. And I have these podcasts on the major apps, you know, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. I have them on those major platforms. I have a USMLE, a YouTube channel called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. So you can go ahead and check those out. And then, you know, many of you know I'm a Christian. So I do have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. 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 There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. Many people have said that, oh, Divine, I love these little life lessons you put at the end of some of your podcasts. So I decided to basically make a separate website where every week I post like 2 podcasts, about 10 to 20 minutes long, where I address a life lesson from a biblical perspective. Again, many people have listened to those, found those to be extremely helpful. So go ahead and check those out. So I'll see you in the next podcast. The one thing I'll just say to you today is whenever you face a tough circumstance, so think of this as a mini life lesson. Whenever you face a tough circumstance, be quiet and try to be constructive. Be measured in your steps, because usually when people face chaos, when people face catastrophe or disaster, they start doing a lot of irrational things. But I promise you, even in a situation of chaos, even in a situation of disaster, you can make good, wise choices. Take a step back, be patient, be calm, be gentle when a tough circumstance comes, and then think, process, ask yourself, okay, what is the rational approach in this situation? What do I do, right? Many times quietness and even just doing nothing is the best move in a chaotic circumstance. Sometimes just doing nothing. Because when you do nothing and take a step back, it then causes you to ponder the situation rationally and begin to do like just wise things, right? Begin to do just wise things. I mean, you see this in many situations of life where catastrophe happens and people just like, I must do something. But in those things they do end up adding to the problem instead of actually like solving the problem. So again, just realize the importance, recognize the importance of stopping, looking, listening, thinking in the course of a bad situation. Okay, well, I'm going to stop blabbering for now. I'll see you in episode 469. Bye for now. God bless you.